From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Verlat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Geographer David Lopez Carr studies how humans react to climate change. He says people who live in rural sub-Saharan Africa are most at risk.
Most people are farmers, and they're depending directly on rain-fed agriculture. So if there's not rain to survive, they have to often migrate. Sometimes they don't survive, and that's what we're trying to understand.
I'll talk with Lopez Carr about the dynamics between humans and the environment. But first, Rebecca Cruz and I will discuss heightened tensions in the Koreas and first-round presidential election results in France.
Is not necessarily this election, but the parliamentary elections that are coming in June. Those are the ones that may actually be more important.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. Rebecca Cruz, let's start with the Koreas. There is definitely a sense there's some heightened tension going on. It's been coming for the past few weeks. North Korea, of course, engaging in various missile launches and parades, military parades, showing of force, lots of rhetoric going on. In the U.S., too, I mean, this is obviously a very sticky situation for the Trump administration, but sending a carrier and into the area, also engaging with military exercises right now with South Korea. All 100 senators invited to the White House for a briefing on North Korea. So give us the lowdown here and tell us, are we really kind of heading into a darker place?
It's really hard to say right now. We're getting a lot of mixed signals, I would say, from North Korea and from the United States both. And that's been one of the criticisms, is it's a little hard to know what's really going on. One interesting event or something that's happening is that we're seeing some collaboration between Russia and China on North Korea. They are the two countries that are North Korea's biggest ally. And even though we have the United States and many other countries has significant sanctions on North Korea and are looking to increase those sanctions, China and Russia have become their biggest economic importers and exporters to some degree. So that's an interesting trend that we're seeing there. We also, as you said, the United States has started to engage more in the region. We just sent over the equipment for the THAAD defense system. It's the thermal high altitude area defense system. This was going to happen by the end of the year, something that was determined under the Obama administration. But this recent situation has caused us to send that over earlier. What's so interesting, China is obviously not real happy about this because they've got their own security concerns and their own influence aspirations in the region. But also South Koreans are not real excited about this. And there were a number of protests. They're concerned, of course, that they are going to become even more of a target because this defense system is there in place. We also see Rex Tillerson is going to be holding a meeting with the UN Security Council, with this being the main topic of focus. So it's hard to tell if this is any different than the usual activities that we start to see around this time of year, the annual parades and stuff. This is usually marked significant anniversaries in North Korea, and the annual military exercises that South Korea and the United States do. That's not unusual. We're just curious to see if this is something different than we've seen in other years.
Well, despite the what seems to be a show of force and a statement that everything's on the table, the U.S. still seems to be saying they're going to rely on China to manage sanctions. And, of course, the U.S. Embassy in South Korea, the families haven't been sent home, which is always a good indicator that things are getting a little more tense. So, we'll keep watching about that relationship. But let's turn to France. We have a big election coming up, presidential election, in a couple of weeks. We've had the first round earlier this week. Looks like we're down to two candidates in a runoff, Macron and Le Pen. The right wing, far-right National Front didn't do as well as some had expected and seemed to be polling behind this kind of independent centrist candidate, Macron. But we have a couple weeks to go before the election, but tell us what we can expect here, Rebecca.
Well, the polls seem to suggest that Macron is going to win. What's interesting is this is a man who has never been elected to office before. He was an economic minister, was in a cabinet position, but he's never been elected before. He broke with his party, so this is a new movement that has come forward. And whoever wins, what's going to be interesting is not necessarily this election, but the parliamentary elections that are coming in June. Those are the ones that may actually be more important, particularly because these two candidates of parties that are not mainstream, are not significant players in the legislature, that we are going to end up with a situation of cohabitation. The French political system is set up as a semi-presidential, which means the president and the prime minister are separated, but though they both have power. And if they're from different parties, we could have a situation where the president deals with foreign relations, whereas the prime minister then deals with domestic and economic situations. And so if those two parties don't match up, we could be looking for a very tenuous situation. We are hearing that a lot of people are saying they're not going to vote in this coming election. So the more people that don't vote, that seems to favor Le Pen.
Well, the numbers would indicate that there are a good number of 40% people or so, 40% of the population in France that are kind of looking toward that anti-immigrant, anti-EU yes. stance, whereas Macron, you know, young, like you said, hasn't been elected to office before, but will be hard on the Brexit and more favorable to the EU. So this has huge implications either way in France. We'll definitely be watching what happens there in a couple weeks. Thank you so much, Rebecca, as always.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org. Or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at WorldviewsKGOU, and I'm at Suzette Guerlat. Next, I'll talk with geographer David Lopez Carr about how people react to environmental change. I'm Suzette Guerlat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlat. David Lopez Carr is a professor of geography at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and director of the Human Environment Dynamics Lab. His research focuses on links between human populations and the environments in which they live, and he has worked on projects based in Latin America, Africa, and Asia. David Lopez Carr, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, David, you have had a very impressive career in environmental issues. You're a professor of geography, but you direct the Human Environment Dynamics Lab. Can you tell us what you do in that lab? Is it an actual lab? I mean, tell us what you do.
Right. Great question. So, you know, I'm trained as a social scientist first, but I, as a geographer, I connect to the physical sciences as well, and so environmental change and ecological change. So the sort of questions that I'm interested in pursuing are those that involve how are humans interacting with the environment. And the causal arrow goes both ways. You know, humans impact the environment. So much of my work is on deforestation in the tropics in Amazon or the Maya rainforest in Guatemala. But then humans also react to environmental change. And so increasingly much of my research looks at that aspect of human environment dynamics, particularly examining climate change and its impacts on food security, crop production, and human health, and particularly infant mortality, because babies and infants are the hardest hit when there are food shortages. So these are kind of the topics that I deal with. And I do get this question, you know, is this, to what extent is this a lab, right? So no, we're not like bringing in soil samples, though our colleagues do at our labs next door. You know, it's more like a group where our doctoral students and postdocs and convene to work. I'm also co-director of a University of California system-wide involving all 10 campuses, Center for Planetary Health. And that we just launched that center this fall.
The key word to me in your lab is really dynamics, given that this dynamic relationship between both humans and the environment. I like how you put that the causal arrow goes both ways and that they each interact with each other. So it seems to me a very dynamic relationship, but it's also a very broad relationship. I mean, you've listed a number of issues that we are concerned with. So how do you work in a field where it is such a broad issue and there are many more, right, that you could add to this list?
Yeah. That's a great question, you know, and some people do ask me, you know, how human environment dynamics, you know, this can encompass so many things, and how do you focus? There's a couple of things I'd like to mention about this. So one is that, you know, to some degree, despite this being an area that encompasses so many themes and interactions among themes, it's only in recent years that academics, you know, professors research human and social systems in an integrated fashion with the environment. And so because of that, there's this opportunity almost to, you know, label oneself, you know, doing these broader themes. And because conceptually we are concerned with these broader themes, even though, of course, when we're training students, we have to be very, very specific. My own expertise specifically within human environment dynamics is particularly how human populations interact with the environment. So how is population size, density, distribution, mobility involved in deforestation, for example, in the tropics? Similarly, how is it involved with where people are most vulnerable to climate change?
And so in where is that?
Africa.
Yeah, I was going to say, where is that? Let's talk about where people are most vulnerable.
Pursuing that very question, before we get into the dynamics of how this is happening and thus how can we prevent it, how can we suggest policies to prevent problems associated with climate change, we asked ourselves exactly that question. As a geographer, well, first thing we do is we make a map. And we made a map by taking existing data on climate change by using anomalies in temperature, evapotranspiration, and precipitation. So evapotranspiration is basically how well the soils are retaining water, which is ultimately the most important thing for crop production. We link that data with demographic and health surveys. Demographic and health surveys are sponsored by the UN. It's probably the largest ongoing survey of human populations worldwide to map out where are areas of high population growth, density, coupled with anomalies in particularly, you know, high temperatures, sub-Saharan Africa, aridity, you know, lack of rainfall, and low level of evapotranspiration. And where we found these hotspots emerge are in sub-Saharan Africa. And some patterns we expected and others surprised us. You know, we knew that, for example, the Lake Victoria Basin, Eastern Africa has a lot of people, so there's a lot of vulnerability there. And we know that the Sahel, sort of in central Western Africa, is also experiencing dramatic climate change and increasing aridity. But what we didn't know is where these two forces, the climate side and kind of the human population side, collide most vigorously. And it came out in Eastern Africa quite a lot, where you do have the combination. And in sort of pockets in across sub-Saharan Africa, particularly where there are higher rural population densities. So a lot of people essentially on limited farmland that is also undergoing climate change and reduction in precipitation. So for most of the developing world, especially talking sub-Saharan Africa, most people are farmers and they're depending directly on rain-fed agriculture. So if there's not rain, they either, to survive, they have to often migrate. Sometimes they don't survive, and that's what we're trying to understand.
You're listening to my conversation with David Lopez Carr. He's a geographer at the University of California, Santa Barbara, where he directs the Human Environment Dynamics Lab. After the break, we'll talk about climate change and migration. I'm Suzette Gerlot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gerlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Our guest today is University of California, Santa Barbara geographer David Lopez Carr. He studies the impact of humans on the environment and how a changing environment affects human behavior. Before the break, we were discussing why some populations in sub-Saharan Africa are particularly vulnerable to climate change. In sub-Saharan Africa, let's just talk about this for a second, because obviously the climate change issue is, you know, you're scientifically studying that, you're able to produce the data. you're undoubtedly looking at the causes of this happening, but what about the consequences? You were getting at that at the end, right? Migration, the fact that you know, farmers are having to migrate, people are struggling and suffering, but it's also causing conflict, right? Is that one thing that we don't fully understand, is the impact between climate change and desertification, or changes in you know, rain patterns, that sort of thing, and the impact on the conflict over the land that we see, let's say in Sudan, for example?
Excellent question. And first, let me talk a bit about the climate change aspect. You know, so that we are confident that our anomalies that we're observing are actually climate change and not short-term anomalies, right? That might be random. We use data that goes back at least 30 years, and by doing so, we have higher confidence that it is part of a longer-term global climate change pattern. One, two. That being the case, just to be clear, that doesn't mean we can say with confidence that in any one specific place where there are climate anomalies, let's say temperature and precipitation anomalies, it is from climate change. And this is the scale issue that makes this complicated. So again, to be clear, we're pretty confident that at a regional scale, what we're seeing, these signals, are part of a larger climate change pattern. We have very high confidence about that. Okay. At any one place, in any one event, it's harder to ascertain that with complete confidence. But so what happens in sub-Saharan Africa? You have decreased precipitation, and with that, households depending on rain-fed agriculture, essentially you're cutting off their lifeline. You need water to grow your crops, and you know they have several options then to respond. They can migrate. They can try to find off-farm labor. They can maybe choose to have fewer children even. These are all potential responses, and they all have potential limitations. And so we often refer to trap populations where there aren't real migration opportunities, and people remain, and they have to do the best they can. And what we are observing is that with that, we do see increased mortality, particularly among infants and children who are the most vulnerable to food shortages.
I think the thing that, you know, we talk about the environment so much on the show and elsewhere, I mean, obviously it's a huge issue. It's just making those causal connections and consequential outcomes visible. You're putting out information not only so governments can perhaps make better decisions, but also so activists and interested individuals can take up that information that you've provided, that scholarship, that scientific research that you've provided, and actually, you know, lobby or pressure governments to do what we think they need to do. But isn't it harder and harder the further you get from, you know, something that's causing infant mortality, for example, to say climate change in sub-Saharan Africa is, you know, directly linked to infant mortality? That just seems like that's so hard to make that so visible that we can actually develop better policies.
This is a very interesting and complex question. One thing that I like to tell people in these sort of circumstances, in terms of how we're seeing the arc of human environment dynamics unfold over time, is that if you go back to, you know, the vast majority of human history as hunter-gatherers, our impact on the environment was very intimate and sudden in space and time. The impact is here. The impact is now. Increasingly, that's much more complex. You know, the impact is in a different place and a different time. So, you know, particularly in more advanced economies, like here we are sitting in Oklahoma and we're, you know, having our breakfast, and the eggs might be local, but, you know, other components of that breakfast, especially the coffee, for example, certainly isn't from Oklahoma. So we're buying products that are coming from all over the world, and we're using fossil fuels for this transportation. And so these impacts are happening in this very complex way over space and time that's seemingly disconnected to any one individual's actions, and therefore is also very difficult to study scientifically.
Well, and clearly the complexity also, it affects how well we can address these things. And I can't have this conversation with you without asking the question, now that we are, you know, into the Trump administration, and it's been very clear that perspectives on this issue have shifted somewhat from the last administration to this. But in general, politicians struggle with this issue, and perhaps because it is so complex, because it has been politicized. But first of all, how do you feel about where this administration is going on this issue, on environmental issues, as we have, for example, a director of an EPA that's a climate change denier? And then, you know, where do you find hope? Where is it that we need to concentrate our attention?
These are challenging times for those of us who are concerned about the impacts of growing populations on limited resources under climate change, where we also see conflict arising from these issues. You know, I think in the short term, at the federal level, I'm not particularly optimistic about where things are going. I've already sensed from my own work where there's issues of limitations, consequences potentially for what we write, what we say, how we say it. There's efforts to limit, to control information. And any society that wishes to become self-actualized, truly have a functioning democracy, really solve problems that are in the best interests of everyone, we first need an open, free press, exchange of information. As professors at major research universities, it's imperative that we have academic freedom. It's imperative that we all understand that facts are facts and they're unassailable. And we can and should argue over opinions. We should never waste our time arguing over facts. This is something that we should be teaching our children very vigorously in the public schools starting in grade one.
So that's where you find hope, is in early education, educating our children early on.
Absolutely. You know, I think we must not allow that budgets shrink for K-12 education. It's imperative that we increase the education, particularly around critical thinking skills. And critical thinking skills you can and will learn from a diverse array of disciplines.
Well, David, thank you so much for being here today. Undoubtedly, this is going to be an issue we continue to talk about, and I really appreciate you sharing your thoughts and perspectives and your research with us. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
That's David Lopez Carr. He's the director of the Human Environment Dynamics Lab at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, and Jacob McClellan edited and produced the show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gorlotte.